We're going to be in 1 Samuel chapter 17 this morning, if you want to open up in your Bibles there. What we're going to witness this morning is the ultimate cage match. All right, two men enter and only one man leaves. And a lot of fairy tales and novels and movies have been based on this very simple story of David and Goliath. You all know this story. Now, you've heard this story. If you grew up in church, if you've been in a children's ministry, in a youth ministry, if you've been in church for any length of time, you've heard this story. We all know it. But there's certain elements of this story that I think we forget sometimes. Now, there's a normal way that we typically preach David and Goliath in a church. And it usually goes something like this. We set David up as ourselves, and we set Goliath up as whatever problem that we're facing. And so we teach it, you know, do you have a problem in your marriage? Like, that problem is Goliath, and you just need to, like, take a step out in faith and slay that giant. Or are you afraid of evangelism? You just need to sling that stone, like, take that step forward, step out in faith. You get in the game, and God will take care of it. And that's typically how we teach it. We set Goliath up as the problem that we think our audience is facing. And I'll be honest, this works great at youth camp. Okay, especially on like a Friday night when everybody's like exhausted and they're emotionally volatile and they'll cry real easy. And you can teach this and you can do this pump up message, and like by the end of it, everyone's crying and they're ready to go into the mission field. Right? I've done that before. That's how I've heard this text preached at church camps, at church. My senior year in high school, I wrote like a 21-day devotional guide over the life of David to give to our middle school students when we left camp, to get them started like studying the Bible on their own. And when I covered this passage, that's the way that I covered it. I preached this passage that way once when I was in high school. But the problem is, like, this works great when you're at camp, right? But then when you get home, it's an entirely different story. And so as I studied this text this week, getting ready for this message, my eyes were opened up to this in an entirely different way. And so I want to share that with you today. And so if you, like, already left the building mentally when I said David and Goliath because you knew what I was going to say, come back to me, because we're going to go a different direction with it this morning. Because you see, the truth is that pump-up speeches, they work great when we're not afraid. They work great in a safe environment, at a camp, or inside the walls of the church. It works phenomenally. The problem is that when we get scared, we forget. And you see that three times in this text. In verse 2, it says, Saul and the men of Israel were gathered, and they were encamped in the valley of Elah, and they drew up in lines of battle against the Philistines. And then you skip down to verse 20, and it says, David rose early in the morning, and he left the sheep with a keeper, and he took the provisions, and he went as Jesse commanded him. And he came to the encampment as the whole army was going out to the battle line, shouting the war cry. And then in verse 21, it says, the Israelites and the Philistines drew up for battle, army against army. And you see three times in this text that it says that they draw up one against one another in battle lines. They're chanting the war chants. They're shouting the war cry. They're having a bunch of worship services, and they're saying, we can do this. We're going to go out, and we're going to win a victory. And then Goliath shows up, and they take a step back, and they're like, get him, Carl, right? And they're all afraid. They have this nationalistic pride. They're confident in their military might. They believe that they're going to win in battle, that they're going to take their land back, and that they're going to make Israel great again. But then when their true enemy shows up, they realize that they're powerless against him, and they're afraid. They're a lot like my seventh grade basketball team. My seventh grade basketball team, for lack of a better term, was horrible. My entire seventh grade year, we won zero games. Okay, but we practiced hard and we got better. And so my eighth grade year, we came back and we were determined this year was going to be different, and we won zero games. My freshman year, we finally saw our hard work pay off. We went like 1-18. We won that one game. Okay, we were awful. But we looked good in our uniforms, right? So seventh graders, we come running out of the locker room. We sound like middle school girls because our voices are still real high, right? Yelling and all this stuff. And we've got on our blue and gold tank tops and our shorts. And we would hit the layup lines and like brick all of our layups because truly we were terrible, okay? And then we would go into our huddle and our coach would give us the little pump-up speech and you could just like see the defeat in his eyes before the game even started. And he'd go, Tigers on three, one, two, three, and we would all like squeal, Tigers, right? And then we would go out for the tip-off and typically like they would have to tell us which direction we were going because again, it was awful, right? And after like the first minute, we were usually down like 17 to nothing or something like that. And I'll never forget one game our coach calls a timeout and we come over and he's like exasperated. He's like trying to fire up the troops in a game that we all know is already over. And I'll never forget the guy next to me goes, I just want to go home. It's like, are you kidding me right now? Like we're in the middle of a game. But the truth is like we looked good in the uniforms. We sounded good when we broke the huddle, but when the tip off happened, we were woefully unprepared for what was about to happen. And that's the Israelites in this text. And so I could give a pump-up speech this morning about how you need to not be afraid and never sin again and live this holy life. And you would probably say amen. And then we could have an invitation and we could sing, wherever you lead, I'll go. Jesus, wherever you lead, I'll go. And then we could dismiss and we could file out the back and you could shake my hand and say, that was a great message, Pastor. Good job. And then you would go home and you'd wake up tomorrow and everything would be the same. Because the truth is, that doesn't work. That's the safe way to handle this passage. It's the easy direction to go with this text, but it's not what I want to do this morning. This morning, what we're going to talk about is that one thing that you can't beat. What is it in your life that you struggle with? What are you afraid of? What is it that stands between you and living the holy life that God has called you to? What do you do with that thing that although it's like coming into your mind right now, you would never want to mention it inside the walls of the church because that's just not what church people do. It's not what we talk about. It's not what we struggle with. What do you do with that thing that haunts you? How are you going to beat that? And the truth is, I don't think a pump-up speech will help you to overcome that in your life. And so the truth is, we're not David. We're not like David at all. We need a David. And so I want to adjust the metaphor a little bit this morning as we walk through this text. I'm indebted to guys way smarter than me, like Tim Keller and Ben Stewart, for helping me to see this text this way. But in 1 Samuel 17, verse 1, it says this. Now the Philistines gathered their armies for battle, and they were gathered at Socoh, which belongs to Judah, and encamped between Socoh and Azekah and Ephes-Damim. And Saul and the men of Israel were gathered, and they encamped in the valley of Elah, and they drew up in line of battle against the Philistines. And so the setting for this whole story is an area called the Shephelah in modern Palestine. In Palestine, the eastern border is this mountain range. Okay, and in this mountain range, you find all of the ancient biblical cities that you know, Jerusalem, Hebron, Bethlehem, they're all nestled in this mountain range. It's sort of the central part of the Israel Empire. On the western side is this coastal plain that leads to an area called Philistia. It's where the Philistines come from. And connecting that coastal plain to this mountain range is this beautiful valley that's called the Shephelah. It's a series of ridges and valleys that runs into the mountain ranges. It's a very important piece of land in ancient biblical texts. And not just because it's beautiful, not because it's the most fertile land there, but because it is the way that invading armies could threaten these cities in the mountains. And so it's a very important piece of real estate for the nation of Israel. And so the Philistines, they're marching through this valley. They're coming to attack. Their idea is if we can get into the mountains, we can claim the high ground, and we can essentially divide Israel in half, and they'll begin to weaken, and we can conquer them. And so Saul hears about this, and so he gathers his army, and he marches out to meet him, and he confronts them at this valley of Elah. And so the Israelites are encamped on the north, the Philistines on the south. They're both at the top of ridges. They're at the top of mountains. And so really, they're at a complete standstill. Because for either side to attack the other, they're going to have to give up their high ground, go down into the valley, and attack up the mountain, and they're going to lose the high ground. It would be a suicide play. And so they just dig in, and they taunt each other. Okay, but this isn't just like some skirmish. Okay, don't get this idea. This is a full-fledged invasion. They are in Israel territory. They're in Judah's territory. This is enemy troops coming into your town, into your community, and threatening your families. That's what's happening here. And the Philistines aren't like these fun neighbors that you invite to a block party, okay? The Philistines are a very evil, violent people. And so when you see them, the Israelites aren't like, hey, it's our friends the Philistines. I wonder what they want. Okay, they know what they want. The Philistines are very violent. They're into perverted forms of sexuality. They worship a lot of gods, but one of the gods that they worship is a god named Baal, who's also called Beelzebub. In the New Testament, Jesus will call Beelzebub the prince of all demons, or Satan. And so basically, they worship Satan, and their worship involves perverted forms of sexuality. This is a very dark group of people, a dark religion, and they are advancing on the people of God. They're taking ground from them. When I hear that, when I think about that, it sort of reminds me of the human story. All right, you go back all the way to Genesis chapter 1, and we are created in the image of God. We're created to know God, to walk with Him, to have this perfect harmony and fellowship with Him. And then in Genesis 2, it all breaks when sin enters the world. Romans, speaking of the fall, says this: we were convinced of a lie, and our foolish hearts became dark. The idea is that there was an invader in the garden, the serpent, Satan, and he deceived us. He sold us a lie and we all bought it. And you know what's interesting is how that almost immediately manifests itself in Genesis 4 and 5 and 6 in perverted forms of sexuality, men taking multiple wives, and in violence, brother killing brother and fleeing. In Romans chapter 1, verse 21, Paul says this: although they knew God, they did not honor Him as God or give thanks to Him, but they became futile in their thinking, and their foolish hearts went dark. Claiming to be wise, they became fools, and they exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things. Therefore, God gave them up to the lusts of their hearts, to impurity, to the dishonoring of their bodies amongst themselves, because they exchanged the truth about God for a lie. And they worshiped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. And lest we think this is just a problem for people back in the Bible, I turned on the news this week and I read stories that are appalling. I read a story about a student at Virginia Tech University that was just sentenced to 50 years in prison because he was dating a seventh grader. And he was worried that she was going to tell somebody, and so he invited her on this secret date, and then he killed her in his car. I read another story about a 15-year-old who was drugged out of a convenience store in the Bronx, and he was stabbed. And the people in the store did nothing to help him, and he crawls back into the store fighting for his life, and he's seeking help, and they refused to help him, and they kicked him out of the store. I read another story about a guy in North Carolina a few weeks ago who went to dinner with his family, and they sat down and they ordered appetizers, and then he excused himself to go to the bathroom, except he didn't go to the bathroom. He went and he got in his car and he put it in drive and he drove through the restaurant and he killed them. And nobody knows why. I read another story about a guy in California who had his 10 children removed from the home because he was abusing them. He was strangling them, punching them. It says that he shot one of them with a crossbow. And we hear those stories and we see that, like, there's something beautiful about humanity. We know that from Genesis, but there's something desperately broken within us. And you might not have killed somebody. You might not have refused help to a dying teenager. You may have never abused a child, but we all are broken, right? We lie. We gossip, we stab one another in the back, and the truth is all of us have wounds in our past from other believers that should have never happened. We've inflicted wounds on other people. Maybe it's idolatry. We elevate things to the place of God in our lives. Maybe it's seeking that job, climbing the corporate ladder, and it's what we want so desperately, it's what we long for. Maybe it's your students' grades. Maybe it's their athletic career that we put so much emphasis and focus into, and we put so little focus on their spiritual life. Maybe even it's our country. Like, we're going to celebrate our nation's independence, our nation's birthday this week. And I love our country. Our country affords us religious liberties that many in the world could only dream of and pray for. And yet sometimes if we're not careful, we could elevate our country into the place of Christ. What do we put our hope in? For some of us, maybe it's this pursuit of money, monetary possessions, and we pursue those things so hard and it tears our families apart. It tears our marriages apart as we put things in the place that was intended only for God. Maybe we don't do those things. Maybe none of that is us, but we do other things. And the truth is, we're all broken. We all have struggles. We all have sins that we have trouble dealing with. And that's what we're talking about this morning. And the problem is that sin doesn't just invade you. It's not just happy to like sideline your walk with God. It's not happy to render you ineffective, but it invades you and then it begins to mock you. Satan is referred to in Scripture as the great adversary. The idea is that he corrupts you, he invades you, he tricks you, but he's not content to just do that. Then he begins to accuse you. He begins to mock you. What would those people at your church say if they knew? How can you call yourself a Christian when you struggle with that? That's what happens in this text. The Philistines invade. They've taken ground, but that's not enough. Then they send out a big guy to bully everyone. We see it in verse 4. It says, "There came out from the camp of the Philistines a champion named Goliath of Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span." It's roughly 9.5 feet tall. "He had a helmet of bronze on his head, and he was armed with a coat of mail, and the weight of that coat was 5,000 shekels of bronze, or about 125 pounds that his armor weighs. The shaft of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and his spearhead weighed 600 shekels of iron." That's about a 15-pound spear. "His shield bearer went before him. And he stood out and he shouted to the ranks of Israel, 'Why have you come out and drawn up for battle? Am I not a Philistine and are you not servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourself and let him come down to me. If he is able to fight with me and kill me, then we will be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall be our servants and you shall serve us.' And the Philistine said, 'I defy the ranks of Israel this day. Give me a man that we might fight together.'" And so they go out and they begin to bully the Israelites, and it says that they are dismayed, they're afraid. Now, this idea of this one-on-one combat, this champion warfare, it was very common in ancient times. It was looked upon as if ancient combat was resolved, the outcome was predetermined by the gods. And so if your nation's gods were stronger than mine, then your army would win. And if mine was more powerful, then we would win. And so this idea of representative warfare, this champion-based warfare, was a way for the gods to express their will with a minimal loss of blood. And so the idea is, we'll pick one person, you'll pick one person, our gods will fight through these people, and the winner has determined what would have happened if our entire armies fought. And so in verse 11, we see the Israelite response to this challenge. It says, "When Saul and all of Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and they were greatly afraid." Dismayed and afraid. Has sin ever found you there? Has sin ever driven you to a place of dismay and fear? Saul is the protector of his people. Okay, Saul's the king. The army is there because of Saul. He is their leader. He's the guy that is chosen to lead them into battle. If you flip back to 1 Samuel chapter 8, when Saul is first named the king, as the people express their desire for a king, in 1 Samuel 8:19 it says, "The people refused to obey the voice of Samuel, and they said, 'There shall be a king over us.'" Why? Verse 20. "That we may be like the other nations, that our king may judge us, and that he may go out before us and fight our battles on our behalf." Okay, so this is Saul's responsibility. Saul was chosen by the people to fight their battles for them. Now, it wasn't entirely uncommon for a king to allow someone else to be the representative in battle. Okay, sometimes the kings would allow someone else to do that because it was a way for that person to make a name for themselves among the nation. The king already had a great platform. And so if there was a soldier eager to fight, they would allow a soldier to do that in their place sometimes. But in verse 16, we skip down there, and it says, "For 40 days the Philistine came forward, and he took his stand both morning and evening." This happens for close to 6 weeks, and no one comes forward. Okay, this has gone on for far too long at this point. This is Saul's responsibility. And yet Saul has no response. He has no idea what to do. And so what happens in a situation where Saul has no idea what to do? Well, you know the story. God raises up a hero, right? An unlikely hero. He raises up a little boy from Bethlehem named David. And David comes from an obscure town. He comes from an obscure family. He's a shepherd, right? But there's a greatness that's inside of him. And he doesn't show up like you would expect him to. In verse 17, it says, Jesse said to David, his son, take for your brothers an ephah of this parched grain and these 10 loaves and carry them quickly to the camp to your brothers. Also take these 10 cheeses to the commander of their thousands. See if your brothers are well and bring some token from them. So David shows up on the scene and David is not in armor. He's not a soldier at all. He's making a cheese run. Okay, he's walking through the camp with a cheese cart saying, hey, I've got some Gouda for you, Jeff. Monterey Jack, could I tempt you? Like, that's what's happening here. He's making a cheese run, and yet he hears what happens. He hears Goliath. Now, why is David really there? In this time, it was not uncommon for armies to draw their supplies from like the people that were close to them. And so David lives near this area. That's where his family's from. And so the idea was that the army is protecting your family, and so you'll feed them while they do so. And so that's why David's here. But God orchestrates this. So David is there, and he hears Goliath say in verse 26, he hears Goliath give his shout. And then in verse 26, it says, David said to the men who stood by him, what shall be done for this man who kills the Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? It says, who is that guy that he defies the armies of the living God? When David looks at Goliath, he doesn't see a 9.5 foot tall, unconquerable giant. He sees someone who is disrespecting his God. And he's not going to have any part of that. And so he begins to ask around, what's going on? Why isn't anybody fighting this guy? And one of his brothers starts to poke fun at him. He says, why are you here? Go back home. No one needs you here. You need to go watch the sheep. But David just goes and he talks to somebody else. And eventually, word makes its way up to Saul, these claims that David has made. And so in verse 32, it says, David said to Saul, let no man's heart fail because of him. Your servant will go out and fight with the Philistine. And Saul said to David, you are not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him. For you are but a youth, you're but a child. And he has been a man of war since his youth. But David said to Saul, your servant used to keep sheep for his father. Not sure how that fits. He tells him, hey, you can't go fight this 9.5 foot tall giant because he's been training for longer than you've been alive. And David goes, yeah, but I was a shepherd. That would be like if I showed up on the sideline of the college football playoff game between Oklahoma and Georgia in January. And when the game went into overtime, I tapped Lincoln Riley on the back and I said, hey, coach, put me in. Go, who are you? Just put me in. What qualifies you to go in? I've never even met you. And I go, well, I was baking muffins yesterday. And just put me in. I've got this. It's under control. It doesn't make any sense. And so they laugh at him. His brothers mock him. Saul doubts him. Goliath is going to make fun of him. But he's about to kill a giant. And he doesn't do it in spite of his weakness. He does it because of his weakness. Goliath is so busy mocking him that he doesn't even realize what's about to happen. And it's over. And so in verse 38, it says, Saul clothed David with his armor. He put a helmet of bronze on his head and he clothed him with a coat of mail. And David strapped his sword over his armor and he tried in vain to go, but he had not tested them. And David said to Saul, I cannot go with these, for I have not tested them. And so David took them off. I've always wondered why Saul is okay with letting this little shepherd boy go into battle. I mean, the idea is that if our champion loses, we'll serve you. You're putting your whole hope on this one guy. But I think Saul is so afraid that he doesn't know what else to do. And I've always seen this part, he's giving him the armor, like he's trying to give David the best chance possible, but I don't even think that's really true. You see, the king's armor would have been very distinctive. It would have looked different. And so when you consider that, I think it starts to make sense why Saul sends David out. In his mind, David doesn't have a chance. But on the off chance David were to win, he's wearing the king's armor. Saul could claim he was the one that fought Goliath. But more than likely, when David dies, Saul can flee, and everyone will think the king's dead. And so honestly, I think Saul pushes David out to the battlefield in an attempt to fake his own death, to escape this situation, because he simply doesn't know what to do. In verse 40, we read on, and it says that he took his staff in his hand, and he chose 5 smooth stones from the brook, and he put them in his shepherd's pouch. His sling was in his hand, and he approached the Philistine. Now, you probably have the wrong picture when you think about this sling. We think of like the little rubber sling, right, that you get at Walmart that you stretch back like this and then it breaks and snaps you in the eye. That's not what we're talking about. This would be like a leather strap that would have a pouch in the middle of it. And so you would put a projectile in the pouch, you would grab the ends and you would whirl it around. Slingers would whirl their sling at 6 to 7 revolutions per second. Okay, and then once you got it up to speed, you would let go of one end. And it would snap, and the projectile would come flying out. A very good, experienced slinger could sling a projectile at around 100 miles per hour. And they were accurate up to 200 yards. Okay, from medieval tapestries, we have depictions of slingers shooting birds out of the air with their slings. Okay, this is a very devastating weapon in war. I ran some ballistic calculations, which I realize is probably the nerdiest thing I've ever said from a pulpit before, and I'm not going to bore you with the math, but I ran some calculations on this, and that rock coming out of the sling at 100 miles an hour would have roughly the same stopping power as a 45 caliber firearm. Okay, this is a devastating weapon. And so David steps forward. He slings the rock, and Goliath falls. And David kills Goliath, not just as an inspiration for the troops. This is not an inspiring thing so the troops can go, yeah, now we're pumped up, let's go. David kills Goliath as a substitute, right? This champion warfare, the whole idea is that as David steps forward, the rest of Israel steps back. And what David accomplishes, the rest of Israel accomplishes through him. And so if you read on in the text, it says that they shout the war cry. Again, it's like the fourth time. But this time there's something different. After they shout the war cry, they charge down their enemy and they pursue them. And they win a decisive victory because their hero had set them free from the thing that they were most afraid of. And so now they were free to engage in the battle that they were meant to be fighting all along. You say, that's great. What in the world does that have to do with me? In the midst of your sin, God raised up a hero. As a little boy from Bethlehem, he came from an obscure family. He was a carpenter. He was poor, and yet there was something great in him, and he's referred to in Scripture as the son of David. When he began his ministry, his brothers mocked him. His family didn't believe in him. The Israelites expected him to come and conquer Rome and establish this kingdom on earth, but he came in riding a donkey. Our king is lowly. He refers to himself as the good shepherd, just like David. And so when he does battle, he doesn't do battle with Rome, but he battles death itself. And for a couple of days, it looks like death won. But then he rose from the grave. You see, Jesus didn't just risk his life on our behalf like David risked his life. Jesus gave his life for us, and he gave his life as a victor. And he didn't give his life as an inspiration so that we could look at that and say, Jesus lived a perfect life and so we can do it too. No, Jesus gave his death as a substitute so that through him we can claim victory. We can claim his sinless perfection, although we could never achieve it on our own because he achieved it on our behalf. He died for us and he rose from the grave. And when we watch Jesus beat death, there's a miracle that happens in us. We see his victory as our own, and we reach out and we take it. You see, we don't fight for sin, or we don't fight sin for victory. We fight from victory against sin. Let me say that again, because I'm not sure if you caught that. We don't fight against sin to achieve victory. We fight from a position of victory against the sin that threatens to invade our lives. We have already achieved victory. Hebrews chapter 12, verse 2 says this, "Look to Jesus, the founder and the perfecter," or that word could be translated champion. "Look to Jesus, the champion of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, scorning its shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured from sinners such hostility against himself, so that you might not grow weary or faint-hearted." We look to Jesus, and we draw courage from him. How do we do that? I want to show you two things real quickly in what David says. In verse 26, he says, "Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?" The first thing that you need to understand is that our God is living. And then in verse 45, he says, Verse 45, he says, "You come to me with sword and with a spear and with a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of armies of Israel, whom you have defied." That word hosts is a military term. It means armies. The God of armies, the God with lots of armies. And so the idea is that God is alive and that he is fighting for me. And when you grab those two things, when you put those together, when you're in the middle of a battle, in the middle of a struggle in your life, you'll achieve victory. 1 John 4:18 says, "There is no fear in love, but perfect love casts out fear." When you come face to face with the thing that you can't beat, the thing that you struggle with most, you look across the battlefield and you see your hero fighting for you. And you look at him with love in your heart. You look at him with love in your eyes. A desire to see Jesus glorified will give you courage in the face of your greatest fears. And you'll go running after him into battle. If you look at Jesus and you say, "You're alive and you're fighting for me," that's where you find hope. That's where you are established in victory. With a love for Christ in your heart, you'll find that you have a hero that has always been fighting for you. And you can launch behind him in confidence. Because the Son of David is a warrior, and he fights for you and me. Let me pray for us.